It is time for Pet Files Ask the Vet, underwritten by the Millerton Veterinary Practice. Traditional small animal medicine and surgery, chiropractic, laser therapy, acupuncture, and Chinese herbal medicine. 518-789-3440, millertonvet.com. With us this morning, Dr. Carolyn Cannon, owner and chief vet at the Millerton Veterinary Practice. Hello, Dr. Cannon.
Good morning.
Good morning. Lisa in the Bronx.
Whoa.
Yeah, exactly. Lisa from the hood.
You have a lot of questions for me today. Okay.
So let's see what happens. Because we know that in the mind of Minolta, we can always find more questions if we run out.
Sure. I was just thinking that you were in a hurry.
Oh, no.
Okay.
No.
I'm ready. I've been up for all of an hour.
Oh, wow. Okay. So
brain is working.
Excellent. It's probably running right around in circuitry. Lisa, mm-hmm. in the Bronx, can you please give me a refresher course on dander? My girlfriend has been getting horribly congested whenever she's around my short-haired Aussie cattle dog mix, which is a bummer for both of us. I know dander's the main thing that makes pet hair allergenic, but does that mean the hair itself isn't? Does brushing frequently help? Is there anything I can do to the dog that would help decrease her allergenic properties?
There are some things you can do. My understanding, I'm not a dermatologist or a human allergist, but I my understanding of it is that it is the dander. Dander being little pieces of skin. So the hair is a protein source, but the hair doesn't tend to aerosolize. The irritation in the sinuses comes usually from the aerosolization of particles that are breathed in and cause some irritation, sometimes severe irritation, which is what it sounds like here. So the skin particles, just the dried skin that you normally lose, it does usually a little piece of skin comes off with the hair. And so brushing can make it worse, except that it can be part of good grooming before your girlfriend's around. So when the girlfriend is not around, do some serious brushing outside and then bathing. So bathing can help.
Is it the little white stuff that...
Well, that's what dries up and gets into the air, yes.
Okay.
So it's a small pieces of skin. So they can... Some people get an allergic response when they touch animals, and it's only certain ones. So it is assumed to be the dander. I suppose it could be the oils in the hair, but probably the dander that causes that topical allergic reaction. And then many people have the respiratory symptoms, either instead of or as well. That's my understanding. And that, thank goodness, I'm not allergic to dogs. But
do you know that I was, as a child, I was diagnosed with allergies to everything, dogs, cats, that everything.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother solved that by saying, you know what, we're getting a dog.
Here's your exposure.
Yeah.
Right?
Ultimately, that is what she did, because we went through the thing, and they had those, I don't know if they still do, but this was years ago, the patch tests, and it just came up. It's like, yes, this is a walking, talking allergy.
Yes.
So
yes, and some people do get better. My understanding is that some don't, even with the injections, get a lot better and can tolerate dogs or, you know, with exposure. But the injections can help. And so, you know, talking to an allergist may be worthwhile for a young person to try to be hyposensitized to dogs.
Or to whatever the animal is. So other than brushing...
So vigorous brushing to get that skin, the hair, the loose hair out with little skin particles, and then bathing. And so, you know, unfortunately, some people with pets have to bathe every once or 2 weeks if they've got someone allergic in the house. And it can dry the pet out, so you need to make sure that you're using a very mild shampoo, perhaps an oatmeal-based shampoo. And scrub right down to the skin and rinse really well to get all of that loose stuff off and down the drain. And so even up to once a week, which can be a lot for a catalog mix, it's a big dog, you can also use, it may help or may not, but high doses of omega-3 fatty acids, will help to reduce inflammation on the skin and hence reduce less, reduce the amount of skin that's sloughing off if there's an excessive amount. So normally the skin will turn over just like our skin. But it does get trapped in the hair. And so if you can help that out with bathing, then that is really the main thing to do.
Is there over, I always wonder, just like as there is overuse of antiseptic soap, for example, is there over bathing or is that the trade-off?
Yeah, some dogs can't tolerate it. So their skin can get very dry. And
doesn't that make more?
Yes, and it would make more, absolutely, but it would cause itching too, which makes more problems. But not all dogs have a problem if you use the right shampoo. I would discuss this with your veterinarian and ask them to ask her, probably, since I believe someone told me 90% of graduates from veterinary schools this year are women. So I should be saying, ask her.
But do you know what's funny about that? I just a sidebar is my hyper anxious sister took her dog to a vet, and she's got one very her regular vet, Dr. Tamara Lewis, wasn't there, and she got someone who was, if possible, even more anxious than she, which she recognized when she walked into the room. And so that was a really interesting combination because you have two really anxious people and a dog trying not to absorb the anxiety. So
That's not good.
No, let that be. Let that work around your brain in your spare time.
Yeah. I would guess that super anxious people don't always make it through veterinary school because it's so
anxiety provoking.
Yes, it can be. It's really the most fun I had in my life, but I have to say that it was hard. It's very hard work, and lots to learn. So, yeah, I mean, you have to work with your veterinarian as far as how much can you actually bathe your dog and not make things worse. So you need to use a nice soothing shampoo.
Can the girlfriend do anything? Like, should she take
the allergy shots?
Okay.
Yeah, see an allergist. Absolutely. I think it's worth it, you know, for the long run. If I would at least find out, my question would be, what is my percentage chance of getting better in a year of allergy injections? Of, you know, because their dogs are everywhere.
Right. That's true. Okay. Now, Emily and Kane and Ugg, my cat, got out and managed to catch and eat a sparrow. yesterday. Is that a health risk?
I think there's a lot of that going around, those birds.
Yep. This is the time where gardeners get really upset.
Yeah, it is. It's unfortunate, but it happens every day. And I can't say that I could say I rarely would see a problem with a cat eating a bird. You know, we don't see obstruction. We don't see bones causing problems. I can't say that I would blame that on any parasites that I'm aware of. Birds, sick birds, could potentially carry something like psittacosis, which might be a problem. But this is all theoretical. Unfortunately, cats eat birds every day, and rarely do we see any problem with that.
Right.
As far as the cat's health.
So the sparrow's health, however, is...
The sparrow's health is not good, and it is...
a risk.
Yeah, so feeding the birds, of course. You have to be very, very careful with cats out and feeding birds.
Yeah.
Or letting your cat out if your neighbor's feeding the birds. But right around here, the bears get the feeders before the
cats, birds get
the birds get
them, and then
saves the birds, I guess.
I don't know.
To a certain extent.
That is true. And many, many, many years ago, also when before we had as many bears as we do now, I had a resident wanderer. And I, like the idiot that I am, you know, I'd put out my feeder and my suet, and then the bear would come, you know, eat the suet and knock down the feeder. So I would put it back, and the bear would, it was just, finally I went,
you know what?
Feeding
the bear.
Yeah. And I stopped.
It can be expensive to feed the bear.
For example. Yeah, plus it can be expensive to feed the birds.
They don't want to go away.
No.
It's just more expensive to feed the bear.
Then they want their
for
own room.
Sure.
Yeah. All right, Julie in Wilmington, Delaware. My fiancé's 11-year-old female spayed lab mix, Bella, has recently begun to drool. Oh, the late lamented Labradoris. The particular way she's drooling is A, horrible to look at, and B, makes me wonder if she needs to go to the vet. It manifests as two thick ropes hanging off either side of her mouth. As I said, horrible to look at. But what do you think of the needs to go to the vet part?
I think that if she's recently begun to drool, that there may be a problem with pain in her mouth. There may be also a problem with swallowing, or the overproduction of saliva, which might mean a stomach problem. So I think of all those things, you can kind of rule out some of them depending on what you're seeing and her appetite. So she's got a great appetite. If her appetite's changed, 11-year-old Labrador who used to eat absolutely anything and her appetite has changed at all, then my concern would be, does she have something going on in her belly, her stomach, indigestion, food allergy? If there's odor to the drool, then more likely there's a tooth problem. Very common. Now, she's drooling out both sides of her mouth, so it may be just in general periodontal disease, but definitely warrants a trip to the vet.
All right, so definitely on a B. All right. Stella's did not. She just let pools of drool until you gave her whatever she really wanted to eat.
Yes, so she was doing the Pavlov thing.
She was just a massive droogler.
Her whole life?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the reasons.
Some
that
dogs are, yes.
They just let her hang out at my house so much.
Right. When we used to live with a Mastiff and a Bull Mastiff at my in-laws when I was in my 20s, and we were staying at their house while they were away, and her name was Moe, and she wouldn't come up the stairs, thank goodness. So if we got dressed up to go anywhere, you'd have to walk partway down the stairs and look around and see if she was anywhere near and run for the door or bring a towel in front of you, because she had always strands, long strands, down to the floor.
Yep.
So you'd have to catch those strands. It was, yeah.
But it's all in the wrist. All right. Dan in Torrington, is it bad for a dog to let its hair grow over its eyes? It looks so uncomfortable.
It doesn't seem to be a bad thing for the eyes. Most dogs, except that you can't see them, so you can't see what's going on with the eyes. But the hair that loops down over the eyes doesn't tend to irritate their eyes necessarily. But it can be a problem with behavior. You get a lot of cues about behavior from a dog's eyes. You can read the rest of their body as well. But with dogs, certainly, that come to the vet, you know, they're anxious. The body has anxious body language. If I can't see those eyes, then I'm pretty concerned about how to approach. If you have a dog who's anxious about anything, then it can be a problem, because if they're startled, they can snap. So that's something to think about as far as keeping the hair clipped. I think it's a good idea.
Okay. Or one of those barrette things, which I've always wondered if it wasn't more.
They do work. They hold the hair, and I don't think they're uncomfortable if you don't pull too hard.
Too hard or clip too tight.
Right, or a little ponytail on top.
Yeah.
But I don't know what the point of that is.
Unless
you just want to leave the hair down at some points. It seems to me that the better vision they have, the better off they'll be.
Right. And the less chance of something just tickling their eyeball, the better you're going to be.
Yeah,
anyway.
Yeah, so. And the less chance of being startled.
Yep. All right, Corrine and Luke in Hartford. Noodles, our family cat, escaped the apartment 2 weeks ago. Thanks to a neighbor, she was found safe and sound, just a little thin and dusty. We are all overjoyed, needless to say. We wonder if she needs some kind of health check, though. A little more info. She was found in an area where lots and lots of feral cats live. I suspect she was being fed by the folks who work at the business next to where she was found. She is a 3-year-old Siamese spayed.
So she was found. She was missing for a little while, I might have missed that.
2 weeks ago. Yeah, so I think she was gone for about 2 weeks.
Okay.
So, Noodles, our family cat, escaped the
apartment.
Right. 2 weeks ago, thanks to a neighbor, she was fine. Actually, quite hard to know from the question, but I'm going to go with 2 weeks.
So if she was gone for a little while, then she could very well have been. So the danger with feral cats is that the feral cat population tends to be much higher in carrying the viruses of feline leukemia virus and FIV, the feline immunodeficiency virus, or feline AIDS virus, as can be called as well. And so those are not typically casually transmitted, but they can be, FIV can be transmitted through sexual contact or through a bite, and the feline leukemia also through a bite or through eating out of the same bowls, et cetera, potentially. The other thing, though, that we found about leukemia lately is that cats tend to be more resistant as they get older. So the most susceptible time is when a cat is under a year old. So even in the absence of vaccination, they tend to be more resistant with age, which is a good thing, but not so the case with FIV. So going to the veterinarian and having her check over your kitty from top to bottom to make sure that there's no evidence that there was a bite wound is helpful. I think it's probably too early to test for those diseases, but she should be tested typically within about 4 weeks of exposure. There's a test that you can run on a blood sample that will test for both feline leukemia and FIV. And I think that's a great idea to do about a month after she was loose, so that you know whether your cat has been exposed and whether, in fact, she's got that virus.
All right, and if it comes up positive, is it treatable?
Are they
asymptomatic?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. They can be asymptomatic for years and years.
Okay.
So both of them are viruses that can be carried for many, many years. So you want to know if your cat has it, number one, so that you're careful about who you bring, about other cats being brought into the house, and what to expect as far as health goes. So they are no longer, neither one of those viruses is necessarily a death sentence anymore, but it's something that you absolutely want to be aware of for your cat's general health, blood monitoring, and just in general, how critical is it to go to the veterinarian with something like a cold if your cat's got one of those viruses, which affects the immune system. So they can live many, many years, but it's something important to know. So that would be the main thing I would be concerned about.
All right. So here's a good one. Ben in New Preston. What questions should you ask a vet to figure out whether they're any good with birds?
Well, I think that the number one question would be, how long have you been treating birds? And maybe how many avian patients do you have? So, you know, that can be important. If you're a veterinarian who has an interest in avian medicine, then typically the word will be out, and so people will come to you, and you'll be treating several bird patients a year. I would also ask, are you familiar with my bird species? So if you have a lovebird, if you've got a cockatiel, if you've got an African gray, I would ask, are you familiar with my bird species and potentially the diseases that they might have separate from others or the things that they might be more susceptible to? I would also ask, do you keep birds at home? You know, somebody who really has an interest in avian medicine is going to probably have birds, and if they do, they're going to be much more familiar with their body language and how to handle them. So those three things. You can look on, there is an organization called the AAV, AAV, the American Avian Veterinarians or something like that. But I know, I don't remember what it stands for, but it is AAV.org. Or you can call your state veterinary medical association. They will often have information on interests that veterinarians have. So it's not necessarily a specialty, or they wouldn't necessarily have to have an exotic animal specialty hospital to know a lot about birds, because you may be in an area that's fairly rural and you don't have that many bird patients, so you're going to be treating dogs and cats at the same time.
In New Preston, yes, certainly. In New Preston.
Nothing close to New Preston, I would guess, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, but that's why it would make sense. But that took me back to your, if 90% or thereabouts of the graduating, I'm sure there is some, there's still active rural, I mean, not every, what I'm trying to ask is there still a general, you went to the vet and you took your cat or your dog or your bird or your, your...
Well, less commonly, there are people who do general practice like that. And, I did some avian medicine at school. I did an externship in Chicago at a practice, an exotic animal practice, so I know how to handle birds, et cetera. But, for me, I have not, because my patients are, one a year, two a year perhaps, then I do nail clipping. We do nail clipping. I know how to do beaks, keep the beak trimmed, et cetera. And, general stuff if there's no one else in the area. But I don't say that I keep up on avian medicine. I really don't. So I don't see them enough to keep up on it, and I don't read the literature, et cetera. So, if you're a serious bird owner and want to have a vet that really knows what they're doing, then I would connect with one right away as soon as you get your bird.
Right. Yeah,
Because you want someone whose staff is able to draw blood from a bird, for instance.
Right.
Who has the right containers to send in the lab work. Who's keeping up on what's happening in avian medicine.
Absolutely. And, there's just absolutely, there is no possible helpful gain of not having a veterinarian or access to a veterinarian who can help with whatever it is that you have. Because otherwise it's just talk about anxiety provoking.
Right. Yeah. Same thing with some of the pets that they sell. At the pet stores, sugar gliders and things like that. You want to have somebody who has some familiarity with number one, handling them, and number two, what do they normally act like? If you don't know what they normally act like, you're not going to know when they're really sick.
Right. And it's just a really good baseline in life. If you don't know what normal is, you're kind of...
There you go.
All right.
That's true.
A little philosophy with your veterinary information. Thank you very much, Dr. Cannon.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
This has been Pet Files Ask the Vet, underwritten by the Millerton Veterinary Practice, 518-789-3440, millertonvet.com.